I was trying to find. Where did it go? Getting there. Yes. Now to Abraham and his seed, where the promise is made. He does not say, and to seeds as of many, but as of what? As of one. And to your seed, who is Christ. And this I say, that the law, which was 430 years later, cannot annul the covenant that was confirmed. Blah, blah, blah. So basically, the seed of Abraham was Christ. So the blessing and the descendants was talking about basically leading to Christ's sacrifice and to Christianity, rather than just to the Jewish culture. So, yeah. We'll get into that a little bit more today, talking about the difference between the Jews saying that they're children of the covenant, but more of the covenant on Mount Sinai with the law, rather than the covenant that God made to Abraham. Now, it's true that they could be both, but a lot of them, especially these Judaizers, were leaning to more just the covenant made on Mount Sinai. Were there any other questions? Yes. Yeah. I mean, because they weren't like intentionally trying to exclude him from salvation by grace or Christian liberty or Abraham's seed. They weren't be like, stay away, like you don't want to be Abraham's seed, like you don't want salvation by grace. But their efforts, their zealous efforts, was excluding them from the benefits of those three. I probably could have worded it better, so I apologize for that. I'll add 0.01 to all your guys' grades just for the confusion on the wording. Yes.
All right, I guess I'm asking. the last question, living under the where Christ was born, under the conditions of the law,
mm-hmm.
Did Christ have to go and make an annual sacrifice and perform sacrifices as he was living for the 33 years he lived?
That's a good question. What do you think, Moses?
I think that if he didn't, that would be something really big that the people who were against him would bring up a lot.
Yeah.
Because that's huge in that culture, and that he would be considered. And a lot of people commentary say that, even, that he was possibly treated as illegitimate and stuff, but even that would be, if not doing that, you wouldn't be even true. Like, you couldn't not. So I think if he did not do sacrifice, if he didn't take part in those things, there'd be a little bit more. That'd be something. If I was a Pharisee, and I was trying to shut down the Jews, I'd be like, "Hey, you know, you don't, you know, who do you call yourself a Jew, let alone the Messiah, and you are not doing, you know."
Yeah.
So I mean, we don't have like any verses that say, "Oh, we have some things." As far as reverence, we don't have too much of it. But I would think just logically that we mentioned a lot more in the philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Now, although he technically would not have needed to make a sacrifice since he was perfect, he also did say to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, basically obeying the laws of the land, like Moses was saying. So I'm assuming he did. I don't think there's evidence to point to the fact that he didn't, other than the fact that he didn't need to. But I think that would have stirred up more controversy and taken away credibility more than would have profited him at all. So that's just my opinion. Did you have something, James?
Yeah, well, Jesus celebrated the Passover several times.
Yeah, so seems like he did. Yeah, and he came and he perfectly fulfilled the law. So I'm assuming that he did bring up, or he did go through the sacrifices and all that business. Is there anything else you guys want to add? Manny's already out. I was like, we're barely into this class. Don't worry, we only have like 2.5 more hours. You're almost done. Anything else you guys wanted to add? Anything else you wanted to bring up before we get rolling? Yes. To nobody in particular, but Manny, there's coffee in the library. All right, so let's get started. All right, let's take a look at the outline for today. We're going to be looking at the difference between son and infant. We're going to look at a personal appeal for better relations and an argument from rabbinics. All right. How many of us did the reading? How many of you guys did the reading this past week? I know it's tough. What was that? Half of it? Yeah. I know it's tough to get through, but amongst some of the strange wordings and random paths, we're like, I don't think you needed to go down that. There's a lot of it to read. It's not the quickest or lightest of reads, but there's a lot of good stuff in there, and it could better prepare you for the class time discussions. So I encourage you to keep on reading for those of you that have. And those of you that haven't been, be convicted and know that you're a dirty sinner. I'm just joking. Yeah.
I keep forgetting what bagged is.
What was that?
It always says B-A-G-D.
Oh. That wasn't what I wanted to do. There's a lot of confusing acronyms that they treat as if it's something that you would all know. But right here in the beginning, there's chief abbreviations. So the bagged is a Greek-English lexicon of the New Testament and other early Christian literature, edition by William F. Arndt and F. Wilbur Gingrich, a translation and adaptation of Walter Bauer, I'm not even going to try that. But yeah, so he uses a lot of short abbreviations, which I feel like doesn't save as much time as he had hoped it would. Yeah. But yeah, that'll be a big help. To kind of stay in touch with where he's tracking. Y'all awake now, Manny? Ready to go? I have no place to be angry because I'd probably say 90% of the classes I attended, I was barely awake for. So, especially with a boring speaker like me, because I'd probably be asleep right now if I wasn't speaking. So, all right, that's about it for the outline. Do we have any other questions about the commentary? Anything else tricky, tough to deal with? Yes. That's fine. Yeah. Yeah. So this week we're going to do chapter 4. Next week we'll do chapter 5. The week after we'll do chapter 6. And then the week after that's our midterm. So we'll finish the book of Galatians, and then we'll go into our midterm. Back me up, my Joshua classmates. I will give you a review guide. And every single thing on that review guide will be on the test, and everything on the test will be on the review guide. So I'm going to give you exactly what's on the test so you can study it. No, I'm not going to try and trick you. I'm not going to, like, give you the questions and answers, so just memorize, like, A, B, C, and D, but I'll give you topics, like, I could say the difference between son and infant, or I can go to key phrases, like this born of a woman. I could put born of a woman, and you'll have to know that it refers to the full humanity of Christ. It may be a reference to the virgin birth, but it's not exactly. It's a correlation with Luke. And then it's correlation to the book of Genesis. Now, you don't have to remember all that off the top of your head. It's going to be multiple choice. There's multiple choice, true, false, and matching section, I believe. So it's pretty basic. I'm not trying to trick you. I'm not going to have you guys take, like, 4 hours to write, like, in class essays and stuff, because I feel like you guys get enough writing done with the DBFs. It's just a way that I want you to know all the key points from the class. So yes, you guys will be fully and completely prepared for the midterm. You guys aren't going to be like, what's on the test? Like, you guys will be ready. So don't worry about that. So we still have this week, next week chapter 5, the week after chapter 6, and then midterm, right? Yes. Yeah, actually, thank you. I forgot about that. Yeah. I know, your test would have been so much easier without Matt. No, it would have been on there. I just would have forgotten to tell you until later. Also, there's a small portion where we'll have like key passages. I'll give you the passages, and you just have to describe for me the theme. Like, it doesn't have to be like a paragraph. It just has to be like a phrase that describes it. Like if I gave you a theme, or if I gave you a passage, you could just put Christian liberty versus the bondage of the law, or something that encompasses the whole text, something that sums it up. And if you have any questions on it, I will go over it with you. I will get here an hour early that day. If you guys want to have a review session, if you want to come in, those seem pretty beneficial. But of course, I already knew all the answers, so I don't know if it was beneficial or not for the people that didn't. But yes.
I can't remember. Are you going to give us enough feedback for DBS?
Yes. Yeah. I'm working on that. I'm so sorry. I know I'm being terribly irresponsible. I'm not always like this, but I am kind of sometimes. I'm working on it. I'm trying to get caught up. I will get those to you as soon as possible. And you guys should want me to slack off, because the longer I delay it, the longer the grace period goes for easy grading. So, so there's some benefit to me being lazy. But yeah, I'll get those back to you as soon as possible. Yes. I put in some quizzes, but I'm still working. I'm waiting until I finish all the DBFs, and then I'll throw them in there, and then your grades will be updated. So if you see your grade on there now, it is like 2 or 3 quizzes worth. And check your grades every once in a while. See if there's any blank spots, if you're missing anything. Like the first quiz, I had a quiz with no name on it. So if you have a blank spot on yours and you would like a grade for your quiz, you have to either retake it or prove that that's yours. So make sure you're putting your names on stuff. And yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I understand. I don't know. It's one of those things, like, there's always so much stuff going on that, like, I want you guys to learn. I want you guys to be here as often as possible, but I'm not going to, like, ruin your grade if you have, like, a doctor's appointment or you can't get off work or something. Like, I understand. So, yeah, last semester I almost made it so you couldn't make up the quizzes, but then right as that was happening, my wife was having trouble with her school because her grade would still get docked significantly if she was absent, even if she had like a doctor's note or whatever. And she's like, I can't believe they're doing this. And I was like, well, I guess I should be a little nicer in my class. So, yeah, you guys should be thankful for her Crohn's. It's a joke. Come on. She's not here. She's fine. Yeah. Hey, I haven't started. Have we started it yet? Oh, dang it. I wouldn't say anything behind her back that I don't say to her face. She's a good sport. on that note, let's get back to the Bible, because some of us need it. all right, so we're going to talk about the first. Oh, I'm sorry, I totally just jumped the gun because I was trying to avoid me making fun of my wife. Do we have anything else about quizzes or midterms or really anything about the class before we get going? Nope. Okay. And I'm assuming most of you guys are already like 80-75% of the way done with your exegetical essay, right? Yeah. Yeah. That's due this Friday, so I'm just joking. It's not. No, it's due in November. I think November 16th, something like that. Yeah. What was it? The exegetical essay? Yeah, it's on the syllabus. It's under the assignments that we have. 21st, thank you. Yeah, so November 21st. All right, so if we have time at the end of class today, I actually want to try and squeeze in some time to work on the exegetical essay, because I know that you guys are going to procrastinate, because I would have done the same. So I want to help you guys. I want to encourage you to get started early, because remember, if you get in a completed rough draft, and what that means is it meets the minimum word requirement, and it hits all the points on the outline, then you'll get 10 points added to your grade if you get that in a week early. All right? Does that make sense? So it pays off to get stuff done in advance. Yes.
I have a question.
Yes. For exegetical essays? Yes, Christina.
Oh.
That worked out well. Perfect. Yeah, I'll just do both then. but yeah, I will be grading according to my outline, which thankfully is similar to the Bible colleges. So yeah, it's pretty standard stuff. You did it last semester. It's just MLA. Like, I don't want you don't do it in like Turabian. I don't need like a huge like cover page, or I don't need like size 36 font or like pink font or whatever it is. So just stick to the basics. Stick to the normal MLA with citing each thing that you get, doing the reference list at the end. And yeah, yes.
Is there anything extra that we need to know about the essay that's not
in the syllabus? I'm hiding some things for you, and you have to guess. No, basically, I'm sorry, that was really sarcastic and rude. That was not necessary at all. I'm sorry. Sometimes words come out, I'm like, why am I saying this? I apologize. No. Basically, if you follow everything on the outline, you're good to go. Yeah, I'm so sorry. That was not nice at all. I'm a terrible person. Basically, if you follow the outline, if you hit every single point, then you're good to go. That's why I have it. It seems overwhelming how long the outline is, but if you hit every point on there, like I'll tell you exactly what I want to see on there, and then just fit it within the word length and MLA format, and you're good to go. Cool. So, anything else? Nope. Okay. So let's move on to Galatians chapter 4. So the difference between son and infant. Let's read that. Open up your Bibles to Galatians 4. Can I get a volunteer to read the first 5 verses for me? Go for it. Perfect. So this contrast between being a child and being a son, that's where we're going to see this the first section of the outline, the difference between son and infant. We'll get into that more. But can I have somebody read verses 6 through 11? Go for it.
Which you desire again to be in bondage. You
Perfect. Thank you so much. All right. So, the difference between the son and infant, we're talking about here where it says in verse 1, now I say that the heir, as long as he is a child, does not differ at all from a slave, though he is master of all. So we're going to see in the beginning of this passage, this child that's the same as a slave, this child that needs to be under guardians and stewards, and we're contrasting that to the end of verse 5, where it says that we might receive the adoption as sons. So transitioning from that child that needs a guardian and a steward to a son of God, an adopted son of God. So this child is not yet old enough to fulfill the terms of the father's will. Now the commentary goes back and forth saying it could be an age thing, but it's more of a wisdom or a knowledge aspect of age, being able to comprehend what's going on, needs to learn certain things, needs to be able to understand certain things in order to carry out the terms of the father's will. So this child is under guardians and stewards until the time appointed by the father. And what do these guardians and stewards represent? The law. We found that out. So the law was there to bring people up to prepare them for Christ's sacrifice. So this child, were the Israelites, right? They were being brought up by the law. They were learning under the law. They were realizing their desperate need for a savior. So this law was guarding them. It was instructing them. It was keeping them and pointing them to Christ, right? So the law brought them up. Let's look at Galatians 3. 23-25. So it says, but before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterward be revealed. Therefore, the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. Right? So this child is being brought up. The law is tutoring it, or it's being its guardian or steward. And it's bringing it up, right? It was necessary for a point in time, but it wasn't meant to be for the child's whole life. This tutor, this guardian, or this steward was there to instruct it, to teach it, but once it's taught it all that it can, there's no reason for it to hang around anymore. That's what these Jews were doing. They were like a child that keeps growing and growing, and all of a sudden it's a 45-year-old man with his third-grade tutor, right? He's still like, teach me something. Not that third-grade tutors can't teach adults, but that's a different topic. So we're seeing that the law was good. The law wasn't just something that Paul was hating. It's not that he wanted to completely abolish or throw away the law, or he thinks that it was a waste of time. None of that's true, right? Paul knows, he recognizes that the law was necessary, that the law was beneficial, and that it served a purpose, right? It served a God-ordained purpose. It wasn't just something that men made up to lord over other people. He wasn't saying that it was always like this. People just made laws so that they can look down on the people that didn't follow them correctly. He knew that the law was from God, and it was good because it was there to be a guardian, to be a tutor to the people of Israel, to those that needed to realize that they needed a savior. So it brought them up, it prepared them for the point when God would send down his son, make the ultimate sacrifice, and save us all from sins. But there's no need to continue in that, right? So it said, but is in verse 2 of Galatians 4, it says, but is under guardians and stewards until the time appointed by the Father. So we have to recognize that the word until, showing that it ends, right, it's no longer necessary once it's led us to the point of bringing us to the Father. So it says in verse 3, even so, when we're children, we're in bondage under the elements of the world. But when the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. So this born of a woman phrase, talked about a little bit earlier when we were talking about the midterm, refers to the full humanity of Christ. It wasn't like he was like 80% God, 20% man. No, he was fully human while he was here, fully God. Let's take a second. How would you explain that to somebody asking you? How would you explain God becoming man? If God's outside of time, how can he drop himself into a point of time and be man? Does that take away from him being God? Does that take away from him living the full experience? He's like, yeah, I could go through this life being perfect if I was God as well, right? He had it pretty easy. Did he have the full temptations? How would you describe this? How would you explain this to someone? So, was he really tempted if it's impossible for him to sin?
I would say he could be. I say yes, because you could be tempted. You could be 100% tempted with something, but if you don't, you know, you have that choice to not fall.
But did he have a choice if he can't sin? Joey? Pretty solid. So you're saying that Satan was tempting him, but he himself was not tempted to do it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty solid explanation. Yes.
Well, I mean, he knew the Bible. He knew the scripture, you know, I mean, thoroughly. So even like when Satan came and tempted him, he used scripture to rebuke him.
Yeah. So you're saying that he didn't overcome it by the fact that he was God and just like blew everything away. He used means that we as humans could use as well, using the scripture?
Somewhat. I mean, he took on human flesh and became flesh like us, because that's the only way we could be saved, because God doesn't accept anything that's not perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Christina. Yeah.
About how, like, all the miracles that he's
did, they were never for himself. Even when the devil tempted him, he didn't turn those stones into bread and eat it because he was hungry. Or, I mean, if he was tired, he could have just, I don't know, given himself energy or whatever it might have been. But it was never for himself, but it was always to kill others.
Yeah. Yes.
That's huge too, because like that's exactly like if we looked at what Satan tempted Jesus with, Satan even knew that Jesus was God. Satan wasn't dumb. You know, Satan's like, look, I know you're God, so I'm gonna tempt you with things that only God can do. God's the only person that can turn rock into bread. You know, God's the only person that would be able to send angels to save somebody falling down into a 300-foot cliff. You know, and it's like, I think for the simple fact that Satan knew that he was God and tempted him in that, and the fact that he didn't fall, showing that he did surrender those rights, saying, no, it's not within the will of my Father for me to do this. You know, using the scriptures behind it or to fend it off as well. I think, you know, that's just a huge point of how far God went, you know. But I think also, I think it's just like the Trinity. I think it's something that we won't be able to fully comprehend to give an absolute answer because we can't, you know, because even if we ask, well, what is the Trinity, how do we describe that? You know, like there's no perfect way to explain the Trinity because it's so outside of what our brains are able to comprehend.
Mm-hmm. It does, yeah. That's pretty good. Anything else? Yes.
God took on flesh. Your flesh is weakness, and as you said, that he may be able to sympathize with those who are also, so we share that weakness, that he may be able to sympathize with those who have those weaknesses. But I kind of think of, mentioned that Jesus kind of really baptized with the Holy Spirit. John the Baptist was told that upon whom you see the Spirit descend upon and remain on, that's the guy who's going to baptize with the Holy Spirit. And you kind of read about that in Isaiah 11 that talks about what that did for him. So although he shared in the same weaknesses, he kind of operated in a level of the Holy Spirit that he was able to kind of recognize that this is not, you know, I choose to obey God. And real quick though, Hebrews 5 says, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, he was heard because of his godly fear. Though he was a son, he learned obedience by the things which he suffered, and having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. So he had to really experience, in order to be a faithful high priest for us, he had to share in the same suffering.
Yeah, that was a great verse you brought up too, because he wouldn't be just making those vehement cries for a show, right? He wouldn't be by himself, sweating blood, just like, oh, I'm so worried about this. This is tough, you know. But yeah, he really went through it for us. Sounds great. What would have happened had Jesus fallen into temptation?
We would have no sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Now, I bring up that question. Maybe it's because I encounter this more because I work with 12 and 13-year-olds. But hypotheticals always get brought up. Now, usually it's the, like, can God make a burrito so big that he can't eat it? Or, like something ridiculous like that. But a lot of times when you'll be talking with people, they'll bring up ridiculous hypotheticals. right? Like when you're in a relationship, people always like, if I die, would you date someone else? Like, would you? Or whatever. or hypotheticals can get you into trouble, right? Because what are hypotheticals? It's where you think up the most difficult situation and you say, hey, figure this out without any forethought about it. Right? Just wing out an answer and you better hope it's right. Now, I try my best not to deal with hypotheticals when discussing theological issues. Now, there are some that are fine. They're like, if somebody came up to you and they're telling you how they're depressed, like, what would you say to them? Like, those kind of hypotheticals, like, what would you do if this or that? Those are fine. Those you can engage in because those can practically happen. But I just wanted to throw that out there. It kind of just popped in my head because I've had people that have asked me that, and they think they, like, won the argument if I said, like, well, that didn't happen, so we don't really need to worry about it. Yes? Yes.
And that's, I think that's a great issue because I was talking to my dad about that last semester, and we were talking about it. And the big issue is that it's hard to comprehend because you're mixing God with human, and it's like a weird equation because humans are similar to God, but we're so different at a lot of levels. And the whole issue of Jesus being God, so you have what characteristics of God translate into that, into certain characteristics of God that does not have to.
Yes.
As far as the whole holy man, holy God thing, as far as I understand it, God took on flesh, so there was the full nature of God as well as the full nature of man dwelling within him. But in that, you could kind of say that the nature of God overruled, in a sense, the nature of man, but at the same time, he fully experienced in the flesh. Like, God experienced everything that he as a man experienced. So the pain, like, he experienced that. He experienced hunger, he experienced emotion, and in the sense of being a man, he then experienced temptation. And although he is God, and God cannot sin, so in that sense, Jesus couldn't have sinned, but as a man, that doesn't mean that God didn't experience the temptation that he as a man went through.
Sounds pretty good. Yes. Could have happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I always think, like, when the, I tell them, am I asking a question to really know an answer, or just to, like, you don't want to know an answer and asking a question?
Yeah. There's a lot of discussion about that time that's not discussed, like, was Jesus married? Is that fair to the other women that he chose? All that stuff. Like, the point of why I was bringing this up is kind of just to show you how unnecessary hypothetical situations are. People always try and trip you up. Like, yeah, well, what about this? Like, trying to, like, get you caught up on this random side topic that has nothing to do with anything. And so one of the things I want to instill in you guys is the essentials of our faith, discussing the essentials and how to discuss them, not worrying about ridiculous things. If somebody wants, like, if somebody bringing up hypotheticals like that are arguing just for the sake of arguing, they're just trying to ruffle your feathers, just trying to get you to stumble on your words or get caught up on something, so they can be like, oh, you're stupid, your whole faith sucks. Like, you're, everything about Christianity is wrong because you're not sure if Jesus was married or not. Like, that, like, so that's, yeah, so I wouldn't get too focused on hypothetical situations. Like, I mean, sometimes they're fun to discuss, like, oh, what if this, what if that, but for the most part, if it's somebody that's just arguing just for the sake of arguing, is just trying to, like, pick a fight theologically, then I would avoid that. Yes.
It wasn't anything like that. He just lived among his people.
Yeah.
You know, he was a man. He worked. He did what he had to do until God said, okay, it's time for you to fulfill your ministry.
Yeah. That's good. That's a good answer. Yes.
Well, on the subject of free will, we're all created in the image of God. Okay? We all have the free will. If we were robots, we wouldn't have the free will to choose. And the act of love is the will of choosing. Christ was to become fully man, he had to have the ability to choose. But since he was God, he chose not to sin.
Yeah.
And he had the ability to know the right answer whenever it came up.
Yeah. So he's choosing to love us, choosing to complete that sacrifice for us by choosing not to fall into temptation. Is that a question or just a pen wiggle? All right, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, because even when God was saying, to, like, when Moses wanted to, like, see his face, he was just saying, you can see the end of my coat, right? You could just get a little glimpse. And Moses' face was beaming forever, so I don't think we could really handle seeing Jesus walking among, or else there'd just be piles of dead bodies around, not being able to comprehend all that glory. But, yeah. Was there anything else you guys want to add to that? All right. Wow, that was a good discussion. That was interesting. Let's move on. So this being born of a woman may be a reference to the virgin birth, but it doesn't explicitly say was born of a virgin woman or doesn't really get into the nitty-gritty. Some people try and argue that it is. You can do the research on your own, but for me, I'm okay with it just being referring to the full humanity of Christ and it just kind of brings our mind to the fact that he was born of a virgin birth. So now another thing is that since Luke, the author of Acts, recorded the story of Paul, it is very likely that Luke was familiar with the birth stories of Luke 1 and 2. So since Luke was recording Paul's life, I'm assuming there was some interaction. And it's good, or I mean, it's very possible to assume that Paul was familiar with Luke's writings, and Luke's writings include the birth of Jesus. So that could reference the fact that Paul was alluding to the virgin birth, because Luke makes note of that in his birth stories. But that's all kind of just leading you down a road that you can go if you want to, but it's up to you. But the chief relevance of this phrase would be its correspondence to Genesis 3:15. Let's turn over there. So is it talking about the virgin birth or not? Could be, could not be, but that's not really what we're worried about right now. We're looking to what Paul was talking about. So this is Genesis chapter 3. This is God talking to the serpent. He says, because you have done this, you are more cursed than all cattle, and more than every beast on the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. So, talking about the seed of the woman being born of the woman, Jesus was born of a woman. He was brought to bruise the head of the serpent, right? He was brought to fulfill that prophecy, fulfill that aspect. So that's initially what this verse was referencing. But now let's look at the fact that Christ was born under the conditions of the law, right? So it says here in verse 4, that God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. What does that mean? What does it mean that he was born under the law? He was born in a time where the law was being practiced. He was born during the time where the law was still necessary, right? Where that the guardian, the stewardship of the law was still in place, where the law was still seen as a tutor, pointing to Christ. So he was born there, and in order to completely fulfill the law, he had to be born in a time where the law was still in effect, right? He wouldn't come 30 years after the fact and be like, oh yeah, I'm living under the law now. No, he came to completely fulfill the law, so he was born under the law. So Jesus didn't live his life outside of the law. We already discussed this a little bit when we got into the full humanity and when we talked about it on the quiz. But he was born under the conditions of the law. He lived under the conditions of the law, and he perfectly fulfilled it so that he could be our perfect sacrifice for us. You know, this class is flying by. Just too much fun. Let's take a, we still got a while to go on this. So let's take a 10-minute break. So right now my cell phone says 10:20. Let's come back at 10:30. If you came here late and you want to take your quiz now, you can, or you can take it after class if we have time. You can take it real quick. All right, so let's get back to what we were talking about. Unless there's anything you guys wanted to bring up before we get started.
Robert, are all these slides
on? Yeah, they're on Populi under Lessons and Galatians 4. Yep, so the file's uploaded there. What was that? I have not put the next DBF up, but I will put that up today. Was there anything else? Nope. Okay. So, let's move on. So, we're continuing in the difference between son and infant. So, Christ came to redeem those who were under the law. And as we were talking about earlier, he was under the law when he came here. The law was a system of self-justification, a way to redeem oneself. But, since no one was able to, a savior was needed. We've been talking about that a lot in class. That's why the law was pointing to the need for a savior. That's why it was leading up to Christ coming and being that sacrifice. But now that the savior has come, that he made the perfect sacrifice, we can receive adoption as sons or daughters of God. Since we have been adopted into the family of God, God has sent the spirit of his son into our hearts. And some people can get tripped up on this Spirit of His Son phrase. Now, it's not a confusion of, like, wait, is it the Holy Spirit? Is it Jesus? Are they one? Do they kind of split and go back together? Like, how does this work? It's not a confusion of that, but it's more of just recognizing the fact that there is a close link within the Trinity. They're not just three random entities just going about their own business, doing their own thing. There is this close link. Where is that? It's in verse 6, and it says, "And because you are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of His Son into your hearts, crying out, Abba, Father." This word Abba, the Father, it's very personal. It's an intimate title to give. It's something that you would say that a child would call their father, you know, like daddy. Like, I don't really like the phrase daddy. I don't know if you guys do. But I just grew up, like, my sister's older than me, and she still calls my dad daddy, and it's like, why are you doing that? That's weird. But the thing is, she has such a close relationship with him. She lives in Seattle, and even when she lived here, they would talk every day. But now that she moved away, she calls him every single day. She calls, like, each one of my parents separately every single day, and I apparently I'm the bad son. I'm the bad child. Because I'm like, oh, I'll see him in a couple weeks. but she has that such a close relationship with my dad that she still calls him daddy. Maybe it's just sibling annoyingness, but like, I get bugged by that. But that's all a side note. But to say here, this here, Abba, or Abba Father, that is signifying just the closeness, the sincerity of the relationship between us becoming sons and daughters of God and God the Father, that wonderful, that beautiful relationship that's formed when the Spirit comes within us. So the Spirit that comes in us when we become Christian cries out. So that Spirit inside of us is crying out to God the Father, just pulling us closer to Him and giving us that wonderful, intimate relationship that is impossible through the law, right? Because through the law, it's about us. It's about us accomplishing this and that, doing what we need to get done, and being saved for it, right? Like, I'm good, I'm right with the law because I have done this, 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 and this. Whereas with the salvation by grace, it's like, hey, I'm saved, I'm going to heaven, not because of anything I did, but because of the wonderful sacrifice that God made for us, and that the loving Father that He is, He came down, He sent His Son down to save us, so that He could adopt us into this family. So it's based on that love and relationship rather than the accomplishments of a person within their life by following the law. So it is by the presence of the Spirit in our hearts that we are assured of our sonship of God and so are enabled to pray with confidence, right? We don't need that mediator anymore. We don't need to go to the high priest. We don't need to go to this or that anymore because we have that high priest that made that ultimate sacrifice for us. We have the Spirit within us. We can go straight to God. We don't need to go through any loopholes to get to Him. We don't have to do it at certain times of year. We don't have to slaughter any animals when we do it, thankfully. So moving on. It is by the Spirit that Christ lives in our hearts. Let's look at Ephesians chapter 3. We'll get into this like 7 weeks from now, I think. 6 or 7 weeks. But Ephesians chapter 3, verses 16 and 17 says that He would grant you, according to the riches of His glory, to be strengthened with might through His Spirit in the inner man, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend, blah, blah. But all that to say that God has granted us, according to the riches of His glory, to be strengthened with might through His Spirit in the inner man, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. So it's through the Spirit within us that Christ lives in our hearts. And without the Spirit, no one can belong to Christ. Hopefully you guys got that right on your quiz. But let's take a look at Romans chapter 8, the verse that'll back me up for my quiz question. Romans chapter 8, verse 9 says, "But you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit. If indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you..." Let's try this again. But you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. Now, if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his. Right? So we need the Spirit dwelling among us. We can't do it on our own. We need the Spirit to be saved. So the Spirit is a sign of salvation. It's an assurance of our salvation. So God has sent us the Spirit into our hearts to cry out, Abba, Father, and to assure us that we are his children, his sons and daughters, not slaves. This is where the difference between the son or daughter and infant comes along. I know in the beginning of Galatians 4, it says child, but the commentary makes or shows the difference where it is more of an infant sort of thing or a child being brought up, where it was they were still learning, they were still under the tutor, under the guardians or the stewards of the law. And they were equating it to a slave, right? So the child under the tutor of the law was the same thing as a slave, the bondage of the law brought him into the slavery under the law. And they were under this bondage, they were under this yoke of slavery, because they needed to serve the law. They were trying to follow the law, but they couldn't. Right? They couldn't keep going under this law. They couldn't achieve perfection. They couldn't achieve salvation through the law, so they're stuck under this. But once the Spirit came upon them, once they got salvation by grace through faith, they were no longer the infants or the slaves under the guardianship of the law, but now they became sons of God with the Spirit living inside them, or Spirit living inside of us. So that's just showing the contrast between the idea of the son and the infant. So in verse 1, when it's talking about the child that doesn't differ from a slave at all, that's the child being brought up in the law. But then in verse 5, where it says that we might receive the adoption as sons, that's talking about becoming a part of the family of God, fully enjoying the benefits of the will of the Father and all that. So, do we have any questions on the difference between the son and infant? Does that all make sense? All right. Well, sounds good. So the difference between the son and infant, we're continuing on in this. Before the Galatians were Christians, they served things that were not God's. We see that in verse 8, where it says, "But then indeed, when you did not know God, you served those which by nature are not God's." The great sin of idolatry is to serve the created rather than the creator. This is very easy to do, both for Christians and non-Christians. Christians don't do it quite as often, hopefully, but we're still vulnerable to this, right? We still make mistakes. We still are very capable of going off and serving the created rather than the creator, right? How do we do that as Christians? What are some examples of ways that we could? You don't have to, like, open up and, like, give us your testimony if you don't want to, but just some hypothetical. Yes? Yeah, so serving for the acknowledgement of men and women rather than the acknowledgement of God, that's definitely a good way. Yes. Anything, yeah.
As soon as you take your eyes off the glory of God, because it would turn into a form of idolatry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
I think for me personally, I think a lot of times it's hard not to hold family under God, because I think about, like, different situations where I would say persecution or whatnot.
I think about like my baby sister like having to die or something like that. And my humanness wants to hold on to that like really dearly. Like, and it's like, don't ever let that go. Like, and because it's like, that's your baby sister. But, and another part of me is like realizing that there's purpose in that, and there's, you know, that I have to not hold. In a sense, we're kind of called to it. Not really, but kind of called to detachment. In a small sense, not really, but kind of. Whereas then, we still are attached to the family and still love it and stuff, but we have to, like, obviously, you know, priority over family. And when you have people like your teammates, it's sometimes hard to say, like, God, will I be ready to let them go? You know, just realizing that they're yours. They are not mine. The things that I can keep. They're not yours.
Yeah. I wasn't just texting. I was looking up a verse. I was trying to remember what it was. It's Luke. Let's see. Where is it? It's Luke 14:26. It says, if any man... come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. That's tough. That doesn't make it easy, because it's easy to tell other people, like, hey, I'm being self-sacrificing, like, I'm not worried about my own life, because I'm following God. But it's tough to say that about your father, your mother, your wife, your children, your brothers and sisters. How can you say that you hate them, right? It's not that you literally hate them. I don't want you guys to go home from class like, Mom, I hate you. I'm serving God. And like, throw it. Or anything like that. But the way I read it, the way I've heard it taught, I think it's pretty neat, is... I'm just saying that our love for God is so strong, and he's our priority number one. He's so far up on the priority list that it almost seems as if we hate them in comparison to our love with God, just prioritizing. So obviously, God's not calling us to go out and hate those people close to us. And it's not saying that you shouldn't form bonds. You shouldn't get close with people, right? Like, like, I'm not going to hang out with my brother too much because I'm trying to love God here. So, like, back off. Like, no, I don't want to get coffee because I actually love God. That's not what it's talking about at all. It's just that difference of love for them in comparison to the love for God. Yes. Yeah, that's definitely huge. Because the reason why I chose the verse to share with you guys on the first day of class was the greatest commandment, in Jesus' opinion, is that he said to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Or in other translations, it adds in body. But loving the Lord with all your heart, loving the Lord with all your mind is huge. It's a great thing. It's a fantastic thing that you guys are sacrificing your time, putting in all this effort to get to know God more and to love him with your mind, but it's so, so, so easy to get caught up in what Matt was talking about. You're not alone in doing that. I'm sure many people in this room have done it. I know I've done it. I don't even know how this happened, but when I decided that I was going to start going to Fuller, I had people that I didn't even know. And I wasn't like making banners. I wasn't like announcing to the world on social media like I'm going to seminary or anything like that. I told a couple people close to me that I was going to Fuller, and like somebody overheard me in the office, and I had people coming up to me saying that like there's no way I'm gonna be able to love God once I make it through the program, right? Like you're just gonna go through it, and in the end you're just gonna be servicing yourself. You're just gonna be puffing yourself up with knowledge and pride and all this stuff, and just throwing these verses out of context at me and all this different stuff. But where does that thought process come from? That if you go to school to learn about God, then you're just going to get prideful and you're just going to get puffed up with knowledge. That comes from experience with people that have done it. I know I've personally done it. I am a very competitive person. I thoroughly enjoy just dominating people in arguments, which is a terrible thing to do. It's really not profitable. Trust me, from experience, not a good way to spread the gospel. But I used to love, like, I was the kid in, like, junior high that, like, I would, like, research stuff that I knew we were going to talk about. Like, because I went to school here, so we had, like, Bible class. So I'd be like, oh, we're going to talk about this tomorrow. And I'd, like, research it. And I'd just, like, prove how dumb the other kids were because they didn't know it. And, like, yeah, I was a punk. As you guys probably can tell, I'm not the nicest person, especially with my comment to you earlier. Again, I still feel terrible. I feel sick to my stomach. I'm sorry. I'm trying to change. But I definitely know that I have used biblical knowledge or studying the Bible or studying God as a way to serve myself, right? I was serving the knowledge rather than serving the one that the knowledge was about, right? So it's so easy to do that with learning about God, which is weird because you'd think if I'm learning about God, I should be learning from who he is and trying to become more like him, right? But I don't always do that. Also, same thing, I know we've talked about this before, but same thing with ministry. You could be serving God with your mind, you could be serving God with your body, with whatever you're doing, you could be on the outside looking like you're serving God, but in actuality, be serving the ministry. Or, like Christina said, be looking for the applause of men and women. Be looking for that acknowledgement. Like, it's so easy, especially when you get involved in a ministry where you're in front of other people, where people say, like, oh, man, you're so this, or you're so that, or I loved that you did this, or walking in front of people, like, when you know everybody's looking at you, like, look up, pick up that trash that's on the ground, like, like, somebody dropped this, but I got it, it's fine, I love Jesus, you know, just doing those things to appear holy, right? So where we can make our ministry the thing that we're serving, right? Which is a ridiculous thing if you think about it, but in reality it happens a lot more often than anyone would like to admit. So did you have your hand up? I wasn't sure if I caught you in the proofs. Okay. I just don't want to ever just talk over people, and because I know you guys get bored of hearing me speak, so we got to mix it up a little. But when Paul was talking here about the sin of idolatry, it was that they were serving the created rather than the creator. So keep that in mind, whether it be something in your life, even something that potentially could be good, right? A new love interest comes along, or a new job or new ministry opportunity, something, or even, it doesn't have to be new, it could just be your wife that you've been married to for 25 years or 2 years or however long it is, or the ministry that you've been involved with for the past 8 years. You could be serving with the right heart for 7.5 years than what happened to the last 6 months. You kind of get into the motion of things, just going through it, just doing the deeds and accepting the recognition without the right heart for it. Yes.
Because if you send it like holy, like not bad, and
Yeah. So things that, like, just in themselves are not bad, we can turn them into idolatry. That's why we're called to do everything as unto the Lord, not unto men, right? Not even just other men, not doing it for yourself either. So we're called to do everything as unto the Lord, to keep the things that are potentially good, keep them good, and destroy away from the things that could be bad. So that's why we're told to, you know, hate our mother and brother and sister and all that stuff, not for the sake of just being a jerk, but to keep your priorities right and focusing on God. Yes. Yeah, definitely. Excuse me. Was there anything else that you guys would like to add on? What was that? Oh, what, did you want me to expand on that?
No.
Oh, I thought you hit it on the head. Would you like to expand on that? Okay. Do we have anything else to add on to that? Nope. All right. So, all that to say that this sin of idolatry, the Galatians were serving things that were not God's. They were caught up in this idolatry, and they were returning back to it, right? They were serving things that were not God's, and they began to serve God, and now they're returning in the cycle. They're going back to serving idols, right? In verse 8 it says, "But then, indeed, when you did not know God, you served those which by nature are not God's. But now, after you have known God, or rather are known by God, how is it that you turn again to the weak and beggarly elements, to which you desire again to be in bondage? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I am afraid for you, lest I have labored for you in vain." So the Judaizers were not intentionally trying to enslave the Galatians, and the Galatians were not intentionally returning to a life of slavery. They weren't just saying, "Yeah, I'm tired of this liberty thing. I don't like freedom. I'm just going to go back to a yoke of bondage." But since this slavery is the consequence of the actions of these Judaizers and the Galatians following them, Paul is making sure to make them aware of the severity of this situation, right? Paul's not just cracking the whip just because he can, just to assert his authority. He's doing this for the good of the Galatians, because he recognizes the fact that the Galatians weren't intentionally returning to slavery. The Judaizers weren't intentionally leading them into slavery, but that's where they were heading, right? They weren't aware of where they were going, so Paul wanted to cut them off and turn them back on the right path. Now, verse 11, "I'm afraid for you, lest I have labored for you in vain." Is that a question of the security of salvation? Right? Because if he's labored in vain, he labored. He even talks, I think it's later in this chapter, about his ministry for them is like labor pains. Right? He brought them to Christ. He was the one that presented them the gospel. And if they return to this bondage of slavery, does that mean that his his labors or his labor pains were in vain, all the things that he labored in, does that mean that we can't lose salvation? Does that mean we can't? What do you guys think? So if you don't abide in Jesus, do you lose your salvation?
Yeah, I mean, they say that you can't lose your salvation, but you can definitely abandon it, I guess. I believe that, you know, but so you have to abide in Jesus. Yeah.
Yes, Matt?
I think in order to, because no matter what, it's part of losing salvation. Now you, then if you say, yes, you can lose your salvation, now you can
okay.
I'm still kind of working on that, something I'm still kind of to work out, trying to figure out how I would, you know, use a logical argument behind it, but that's just kind of where I fall.
Okay. Moses. Anybody else? Yes.
As far as salvation, though, like, I don't think we can lose it. I know me personally, I think he's quoting one of the Psalms, but, like, Hebrews 13:5 says, I will never leave you or forsake you. So, like, that's like a promise. He's not saying, I will never leave you or forsake you when you are good or if you are good. You know, it's just a promise. He says, so the question is really is, you know, were you ever going to save? And I think I've heard correctly where he's saying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what are the requirements for salvation? Yep. Romans chapter 10, verses 9 and 10. What is it? What's somebody read Romans 10, 9 and 10 for me? Yep. Right? So, confess them with your mouth and believe in your heart, and you're saved, right? It doesn't say if you're saved unless you do this, or unless you don't, if you stop reading your Bible for 6 months, then it's probably about time to, you know, re-up your membership or whatever it is. So, now, once you have that assurance of salvation, you can read that verse and be like, hey, I'm assured of salvation. You're not going to lose your salvation, right? You're not saved until you do X amount of sins. It's like, well, what if I don't go to church for a couple years and maybe I smoke some pot? Is that the line? Or what if I kill somebody? What if this happens? What if that? Where is the line drawn? Now that gets into a little difficult situation about the carnal Christian or the worldly Christian. But the thing is, it's kind of difficult to deal with sometimes. But the thing is, a carnal Christian is still saved, right? Yes. Yeah. See, that's where this question gets difficult, because did they ever know him in the first place? What do they mean by walking away? Are they going to come back? We don't know. My best answer for this isn't like a real satisfactory, like, hey, this, you can win debates with this. But the way I see it is that we can't see the heart, right? Only God can see the heart. We can only see the outward appearance. We can only see the fruits of the labor. James goes into the fact that you say you have faith, or I have faith and you have works, but I say I have faith and I'm showing you my faith by my works. So your faith is shown by the works, by serving God. But if somebody isn't showing it, does that mean they don't have faith or they don't have evidence for their faith? That's a difficult thing where we as humans, we don't know, right? We don't know where other people are at. So that should keep us in maybe, a constant state of urgency is how I want to phrase it, but just continually aware of the importance of sharing God's love with people, regardless of where you think they're at, regardless of how they look on the outside. We need to continually love them with God's love, share God's love with them. And if you're struggling with the fact of whether or not, like, am I saved? Am I not saved? I don't know. I've been doing this. I've been doing that. Take it back to Romans chapter 10, verses 9 and 10. If you can read that and say, hey, I have confessed with my mouth that Jesus is Lord, and I fully and completely believe that God has raised him from the dead, good to go. Move on. A big thing that I've seen a lot is that through spiritual warfare, you can get held up at the starting point. I think I already talked about this in this class, did I? Getting held up at the salvation. Maybe I haven't. I'm not sure. But you, Satan wants to keep you at the starting point. Keep you like, am I saved? Am I not saved? I think I need to go up for this altar call. Maybe I need to go up next Sunday too. Just kind of going back and forth about whether or not you're saved. And you're not progressing from that salvation, right? Just keeping you at that first leg of the Christian walk, right? Not growing in the salvation, or not growing in the relationship with God. So if we're always stuck wondering whether or not am I saved, am I not, you're going to go back and forth. You're going to stay in that beginning stage of your relationship, right? With like what I said with comparing it to marriage. Constantly being like, hey, Erica, let's go back to the court. Let's get another marriage license, like, just in case. I'm not sure. Like, I haven't done the laundry for a while. I haven't done dishes. It's like, I'm kind of just like, I don't know. Like, I didn't do dishes last night after you made dinner. So let's just go to the court, get our marriage license again, right? Maybe I haven't been treating her as well, but we're still married. So we need to progress in our relationship and not be wondering, like, how did this ring get on here? Does this really mean that I'm married? So don't let your walk with God be staggered by the question of salvation. Do what the Bible says that you need to do in order to be saved, and be assured that it's not deceiving you. Be assured that Christ's sacrifice is enough. It's not Christ's sacrifice plus this, plus this, plus this. It's Christ's sacrifice. He died on the cross for you, so you can be assured of salvation. And in regards to verse 11 of Galatians 4, I don't think he wasn't talking about salvation. People have brought it up, whether or not, like, is he talking about salvation? Can you lose your salvation? But I agree that he was just talking about the labor that he's done for them in serving them. And you can see, because the whole salvation issue doesn't really coincide with his whole argument. As you can see later on, he's going and defending himself, like, hey, I was there with you, I was serving you, I had this physical ailment, and you guys are fine with me, but why are you treating me like your enemy? Basically saying, I've built up this relationship with you, I've served you for so long, I've been praying for you, I've been worried for you, but why have I done all that in vain if you guys are just going to treat me or view me as your enemy, right? Did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think you're right. I was reading through 2 Corinthians yesterday, actually.
Nice.
I think it was kind of the same thing right there at the beginning. It says, I'm working together with him. We also urge you not to receive the grace of God in vain. And it's just one of those things, if you read it without reading the surrounding verses and the context, he's not talking about an issue of salvation. He's talking about an issue of ministry. And it's not about whether the grace of God is effective to you for salvation, but whether the grace of God is working in you through your ministry. And that's in the context of 2 Corinthians. And here, it's kind of the same thing. He's not talking about salvation. He's talking about, like, his personal ministry that he has labored with them and for them.
That's a fantastic point. Context is huge. Pay attention to the context. I know I've talked about this multiple times before, but the whole taking verses out of context, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, right? In reality, he's talking about being content in every situation, not talking about going out and asking that girl out, and she's definitely going to say yes. Like, no, Christ strengthened me to ask you out, so you have to say yes. Like, you don't understand. Read it here. It says... Romans 8:28, where all things work together for good, right? So, yeah, I lost my job, but it's going to be good because that means I'm definitely going to get one with twice as good a salary, right? Or this happened, so obviously something even better is going to happen, but where verse 29 says, all that's working to conform us to the image of God's Son, right? That's the good that it's talking about. Did you have something you wanted to add? Nope, okay. Sorry. I don't know, but maybe something's wrong with my peripherals over here. I'm just going to focus over here just so I can catch you and don't keep falsely accusing you of raising your hand. Was there anything else you guys wanted to add to that? Anything else you wanted to discuss? All right. Let's move on. Hey, we're done with the difference between the son and the infant. Can't believe it's already 11:14. I thought I'd have time for the essay. We might not. We still have, I think, 5 or 6 more slides. So let's bust through this. But all this to say, the discussions are important. We can go over the essay at a different time. If you have something you want to discuss, discuss it. This is a time where we can all benefit from each other's insight. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, because we still have free will. He's not going to force us to follow his will, which sometimes I wish he would with me. But but yeah, it's like that. Never mind. But yeah, I was like, I don't know if I want to get into that. But yeah, that's a fantastic point, where it's to the point where we can just go against his grace, just go against his will for so long, that's to the point where we won't even listen to what he's saying. So he kind of just cuts it off right there. That was good. Does anybody else want to add to that? Nope. All right. So let's move on. A personal appeal for better relations. Let's read those verses real quick. Does somebody want to read verses 12 through 20? Go for it. Oh. Why don't you guys just alternate every word? Good reading. So it starts off with, brethren, I urge you to become like me, for I became like you. Right? That's a weird text. If you take that out of context, seems a little egotistical, right? There's that first part, become like me. But then the second part says, for I became like you. How does that make sense? He's not saying like, hey, like act like me, like I'll act like you, we'll just kind of switch spots, we'll act like each other. But it's basically saying, put yourself in my place, for I have put myself in yours. Treat me as I have treated you. He became the Gentile to the Gentiles. He said, hey, I put myself in your shoes. I understood where you were coming from, and I loved you through that. So do that for me. See where I'm coming from. And when Paul first came, he had this bodily weakness. So he called it a thorn in his flesh, whatever it could be. From this passage, actually, people think that it could be something wrong with his eyes. Because they're saying they would have plucked out their own eyes for him. That wouldn't have made sense if, like, he was, like, missing a pinky, and they're like, here, have my eyeball. But it could have just been an expression. Especially with all the, like, the lamps and the lanterns and the lighting and reading so much, could have caused a strain on his eyes. Could have been anything. That's all speculation, though. It really doesn't make a difference to the story. It's just kind of fun to think about. Paul had this bodily weakness. Now, it says here in verse 14, and my trial, which was in my flesh, you did not despise or reject, but you received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. The fact that he said that, hey, you didn't despise me or reject me because of this ailment, kind of leads us to believe it could have been a little unsightly. We know that Paul wasn't the biggest looker. He wasn't the most aesthetically appealing of people. And this bodily ailment could have added to it. So it could have been something where you're is that contagious? I kind of, like, keep your distance. Like, I don't know if it could have been something gross. Could have been something that wasn't. It could have just been he had bad eyes. Yes. Yeah, seriously. you won't be working properly after a while. But yeah, like the speculations from different biblical sources and outside sources kind of give you a picture. It's kind of just a short guy, bald, some sort of physical ailment, bad vision, hunched over, limping, probably has got scars all over the place from getting beat up a bunch. So that's not somebody like, hey, come here, buddy. Like, sit right next to me. Like, that seat's open. But the thing is, these Galatians didn't despise him or reject him because of this, right? When Paul first came, they didn't despise him because of it. And then all of a sudden, in verse 16, it says, have I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? So they accepted Paul, they accepted the truth that he was bringing, regardless of how he looked on the outside, which, as we have discussed, Although we don't know for sure, it doesn't give us a picture of him, which would have been nice. But from biblical sources and reputable outside sources from that time period, we can see that he most likely wasn't the best looking of guys, or the most, he didn't have a gravitating aesthetic appeal. But even through all that, they accepted his truth, they accepted him in, and they he lived with them. He worked with them, he served them, he labored with them, and he loved them. But all of a sudden, now that he's gone, they're treating him as if he's an enemy, right? These Judaizers came in, they kind of twisted their thought process a little, and now they're looking at Paul as if he's an enemy. He's some jerk that's coming in, bringing in this weird doctrine. And but yeah, it says they would have plucked their eyes out for him. That's a huge difference. And I realize I just answered my question of why do they now treat Paul as if he's an enemy, but it's because the Judaizers came in and tweaked their thought process, made them think about their salvation as a salvation of works, something they can earn. I'm assuming they were, the way that Paul's writing this, partially defending himself, partially giving his backstory and all this stuff, leads us to believe that the fact that they were assaulting his character, not only his doctrine. So whatever they were doing, it was obviously working, leading the Galatians to view Paul as an enemy. So he's appealing to them, say, hey, let's get on better terms. We used to be good, we were fine, we worked well together, we loved each other. You accepted me even through my physical ailment, but now we're enemies. What's going on? And then he moves on from there in verse 17. It says, they zealously court you, but for no good. Yes, they want to exclude you, that you may be zealous for them. So they were looking to be the leaders. They were like, I want to follow the law like those Judaizers are following the law, right? But it is good, in verse 18, to be zealous in a good thing always, and not only when I am present with you. My little children, for whom I labor in birth again until Christ is formed in you, I would like to be present with you now and to change my tone, for I have doubts about you. So Paul's worried about these people. He switches from, you know what, let's move on. There you go. All right, so he zealously tries to exclude the Galatians. No, not he. The Judaizers are trying to exclude the Galatians from the benefits of salvation by grace through faith and everything that comes along with that. And they want the Galatians to be zealous for them rather than for Christ. Paul wants the Galatians to be zealous for Christ and not just when he's there, right? Paul's got the right intentions. He's saying, I'm trying to point you to Christ. They're trying to point you to themselves. So now Paul's calling them my little children rather than brothers and sisters. He's been calling them brothers and sisters up until then, but this goes along with the story that he paints with his words in verse 19, where it says, my little children, for whom I labor in birth again until Christ is formed in you, right? His labor pains was the agony of watching the signs of Christian growth in his flock. He's saying it was hurting them. He was trying. He was working so hard. He was in agony for them, and it was hurting him to see him like this, or to see them like this. So that's why he's switching his tone. He's kind of going back, like my little children. He's doubting about them. He's worried about them. So let's look at 2 Corinthians 11, 24 through 29. What was it? 2 Corinthians 11, 24 through 29. My Bible, there is. I was like, you're always trying to get me on those. All right. This is Paul speaking again. It says, from the Jews 5 times I received 40 stripes minus 1. 3 times I was beaten with the rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeys often, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fasting often, in cold and nakedness, besides other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. How huge is that? If I get a little cold, I'm like, the junior high kids don't need me. I'm not feeling good. I'm going to sleep. But he goes through all this. And as he's going through all of these trials, all these perils, all this physical, emotional pain, everything that goes along with it, he's worried about the church. Yes?
I was just going to ask you that, too. Like, being a pastor over the junior highers, and how he's talking about how calling them little children, for whom I labor and birth again. Like, do you have that part, the same part, like, that he, Paul has, you know?
I'm not, like, trying to be like, oh, yeah, I'm just like Paul. But, like, honestly, like, it's so hard letting these kids go, you know, because I just want to, like, keep them, like, here, just stay within the walls of the church. Like, we're fine here. We'll just study the Bible. Like, don't go out. Seeing one of them slide, like, it kills me. Like, where it says in 27, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often. It kills me. Like, I lose sleep. I stay up at night and sit, like, just, like, thinking about a kid, like, worried about the different things that he's going on. Like, because the more you get to know them, the more you're worried about them, and you see the potential dangers. You know that they're weak in this area, and you foresee something in high school. Like, no, don't graduate. Stay in here in junior high. Let's take care of this now, and then we'll ship you off to high school. So, yeah, like, it's tough not to. It's not because I'm some super Christian. It's just God has put me in a wonderful situation where he's made me available to serve these kids, and being around them, serving them, just hanging out with them really leaves you no other option but to love them. Honestly, every year at graduation, my wife and I are just like, I don't want to go. Because, like, you form such, like, because every, like, only we only get 2 years with these kids. We only have seventh and eighth grade for junior high, and you form such quick bonds with them, because when you're serving someone, when you're trying to bring them in, I feel like this is, like, because I've talked about this with other pastors, too. It's just, like when you're looking after your flock, when you're trying to help them grow, it really takes a toll. Like, it's tough. Like, I thought being a pastor, like, because I saw my dad, and he never really, like, showed any of it when I was younger. He talks about it more with me now. But I thought it was just like, oh, you just go hang out with people, like, you teach a couple of Bible studies, hang out, drink some coffee, and you're good to go. But it's tough. Like, seeing kids now that were in my junior high ministry a couple years ago, they're in high school, and they're just making all the wrong decisions. Like, I want to be like, no, like, come live with me. Like, come here, you're fine. Like, actually, well, right, I know it's the best, but right now, one of my old kids is living with me because stuff went on. But, like, it's so tough because I tell kids, I'm like, I want to adopt you. Like, I know it's creepy and weird, but, like, I'm like, they just mean so much to me. It's weird. But that's not from me. Like, I'm sure you guys have seen portions of my fleshly side in class, and you'll see more because I'm a terrible person. But I never cared about kids. Like, I'm not a super, like, tender, compassionate person. Like, I'm not, like, 3 times in my life I've held a baby. So that terrifies me and my wife. But I was a receiver, though, so I have good hands, so hopefully I won't, like, drop it. But just don't throw babies at me. I don't want to test. What is going on here? Me of myself, like, who I am, is not a tender, compassionate person. I'm, like, I still struggle with it today. Like, if junior high gets hurt, I'm like, get up, you're fine. Like, why are you crying? It's fine. Put a band-aid on it, you're done. Like, if you're real tough, you don't even need a band-aid. Like, let's go. Like, it's not broken. Like, if you're not going to the hospital, then you don't need to cry about it, right? Like, I'm a terrible person. Like, I don't know why I'm thinking that this 11-year-old kid, when he falls and hits his head, isn't going to cry. I'm like, I wouldn't cry if I was there. And it's like, well, yeah, like, because I don't have much up here to injure. But, I'm not good with kids. It doesn't make any sense, but I've always been, like, super awkward around kids. I never hung out with kids. I didn't have any younger siblings. But in high school when I became a junior high counselor for the first time, not willingly at all. Let me just clear that. I don't know if I told you the story, but I did not want to be a junior high counselor. My football coach, one of the coaches, was Andrew Newman. I don't know if, well, some of you guys know him. Yeah. he was my football coach, and he is also working with his dad in the junior high ministry here. And we had a dead period where the CIF rulings for high school said you have to have 3 weeks off where it's not mandatory practice. And that's when I was going to relax. I was going to go to the beach. I was going to hang out. Like, I was going to have a good time. But he said, hey, why don't you take one of those 3 weeks and come be a junior high counselor? And I told him immediately, no hesitation, I said, that sounds like the worst thing I could possibly do. That sounds absolutely terrible. I would hate to spend this time with 12 and 13-year-olds screaming at me while I'm doing my best not to punch them in the face. Like, like it sounded terrible because I'm not good with kids. Like, but something happened on that bus ride. Did I ever tell you about the first bus ride up to summer camp when I was a counselor? Oh, man. I get on the bus. I'm so unsure of this because I know God wants me to do it, but everything about me hates the idea of doing it. And so I'm like, all right, God, like, I'm just doing this for you. Like, you better, like, show me that, like, I'm going to be here, like, as if I'm in a place to demand things of God. But I get on the bus, sit down on the way to, like, so I haven't interacted with any kids yet. I just got there, just walked on the bus, sit down. Right as I sit down, the kid behind me says, you can't sit there. I was like, oh, are you saying this for a friend? No. Like, oh, why can't I sit there? He's like, I don't want you to. Like, why don't you want me to? Because I hate you. Now go find another seat. I'm like, this is a great way to start. Like, I hate this. I was like, this is the worst decision ever. It's going to be the longest week of my life. But something happened over that week. Something incredible happened over that week. And it's something that has changed me, and I haven't been the same since. I still show glimmers of my previous self where, like, I'm a jerk to kids, or, like, I think it's funny. Like, we were playing this game where these kids were running. Like, we'd stand at the door, they'd run, and if they didn't get hit by anybody throwing a ball, then they won or whatever. And so this kid was standing there ready to sprint, and I was standing next to him, and I thought it'd be a good idea just to stick my foot out. And I thought he saw my foot, but he didn't, so he connected and just fell flat on his face. And, of course, I was laughing at him. I was like, loser. But so I still am a terrible person. I still am not the best. But something happened at that camp where God, he showed me how he sees these kids. He showed me how he loves them, and I've just been filled with it ever since. I don't know. I can't get enough of these kids. So I understand the way that Paul's calling them his children, how he's saying it's labor pains, because honestly, it's agonizing watching the people that you've poured into, the people that you've seen God work in such amazing ways in to stray away. Not that, like, oh, like, hey, I did all this work, so you should be doing this because I work so hard. But you just see the wonderful things that God has done, and you know the wonderful things that he can and will do if they continue in his love. And you just see all that potential, and it's just, they're just throwing it away, and it just it kills you. It hurts. So when I was younger, I read this verse, and I was like, labor pains? Like, that's weird. He's a dude. He doesn't know what that is. And I don't either. But I do know the agony of watching Christian growth in a flock. And so, yeah, thank you for asking that. So please don't in any way think that I was, like, bragging, like, I love the junior highers. I'm such a good pastor or whatever. Like, I'm not. I can tell you countless stories that'll reveal to you how awful of a pastor I am. But I love those kids. I love them in a way that I personally cannot. It's only that God has filled me with his love to pour out on these kids, and it's incredible. Like, sometimes I feel like I'm having, like, an out-of-body experience. Like, the way I'm, like, acting with a kid, I'm like, this is not me. Like, this is God working through me, and it's fun. It's really great. Just know that serving God, I know a lot of you guys already know this, but it's the best thing to do. It's so much fun. It's not, so many times Christianity can seem like a list of do's and don'ts, but it is by far the best way to live. It's by far the most enjoyable. Like, even just from a selfish aspect, like, I love my life. I absolutely love it. It's tough. It's difficult. Like today, I work from 8 a.m. until 10 p.m. That's a long day. Now, like, all like part of it's like hanging out with junior high kids, so it doesn't seem like work. So I'm like wrestling them and stuff, and then or like I'm coaching football. So it's not like I know you, a lot of you guys have a lot more difficult jobs, but it's still like it's a long schedule. It's a grueling schedule. There's a lot of emotional and spiritual warfare that goes into it. But I wouldn't trade what I do for anything. I absolutely love it. So just be encouraged. Serving God is so great. Even when Paul's describing these labor pains, the agony of what he's going through for these Galatians, I guarantee you he wouldn't change that for an easy life. All the stuff that he went through that we read in 2 Corinthians 11, all those perils, all the times that he was beaten, that he received 40 minus one stripes, like all those things, he wouldn't change that for anything because he recognizes, he knows how awesome a life following Christ is. And I've only been here, I'm only 23. I've only been doing this for a little bit. I wasted a lot of my time, if we're being honest, leading up till now. Like a lot of my youth was wasted. And so I'm still just getting into the game, and I already absolutely love it. So I'm stoked out of my mind to see what's going to happen over the next couple decades. Yes. 23? No, I meant 33 is what I meant to say. Whoops. I am 23, actually. I was born in 1990. So actually, my birthday is coming up pretty soon, so you guys already should. I'm assuming you guys have already logged at least 20, 30 hours in planning my birthday celebration, but yeah, I don't know. Yeah, let the Spirit lead you. He'll guide you. But yeah. So what were we talking? Oh, labor pains. Yeah. So that's why Paul's calling them his little children. So yeah. So if you're going about a ministry and you're doing it for the wrong reasons, you'll know. I know because I've done it. Even with these junior hires, even after that wonderful story of summer camp and how God changed me, I got complacent. I just went through the motions for a while. I just did it to do it. I just did it for the sake of doing a ministry, right? Because that's what I do. Like, it's my career. I'm a pastor, so I do Christian and pastorly things, right? I went through a period where that, and it was miserable. It was absolutely terrible. I didn't enjoy it one bit. The kids definitely suffered for it. Looking back, I was like, I didn't love them how I should have. I didn't serve them how I should have or could have. And I suffered for it. The kids suffered for it. And I'm ashamed of that entire time period. But, where was I going with that? I'm sorry. All that to say that the labor pains are so worth it. Paul's calling them his children because that's how he viewed them. And if you're not at a place where you're seeing that or you're not at a place where you're doing that, pray for it. Ask God, hey, God, I want to have this passion for other people. I want to have this passion to where I can go through all the things that Paul went through and still be concerned for your flock rather than for my own personal being, right? To have that shift of focus where it's taken off of yourself, taken off of your own personal needs or personal comfort, and focus completely on your brothers and sisters, right? Focus completely on God's flock. Yes.
That statement confuses me. It says his labor pains was the agony in watching the signs of Christian growth. Don't you want Christian growth?
Yeah, sorry, the mistakes of the agony of watching the whole process of going through the Christian experience. I definitely could have worded that better. Just seeing them where they were started off, they were doing so well, and then straying away from the growth that they had seen. So yeah, that was my bad on a bad wording. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Like,
You want to know something awesome? That kid that was on the bus that said, like, I hate you, don't sit here. Turns out he wasn't doing well in junior high. First couple years in high school, just dropping down, getting involved in stuff he shouldn't have. And then out of nowhere, because him and I, like, we didn't get along when he was in junior high, because I had to keep him following the rules, and he wanted to break every single one of them while letting me know how much he hated me for 2 years. and then I think it was either his sophomore. Yeah, I think it's his sophomore year in high school. Out of nowhere, he sends me a message on Facebook. We talk for like 3 hours on Facebook. Then we exchange numbers. We're talking consistently. And all that, after all of the agony of that, and he continued to struggle. He has, like, honestly, I can't think of anybody that has a more difficult life than he does. It's rough. And so I sat there, I talked him through a lot of stuff and went all the way, like, we were talking consistently from his sophomore year even through now. And now I think that was 5 or 6 years ago that we started talking like that, and now he's one of my best friends. He is fantastic. He has completely given his life over to Christ. He's serving God. He's doing very well. He's still struggling with a lot of stuff, like with health issues, just all these different things going on that he can't control, that are difficult. But he's serving God, and it's incredible. It's so exciting seeing the point, like, where we first met to where he is now and how much he's grown. And just seeing that is incredible. But those pains of seeing him waver, seeing him go through those difficult times, whether it was because of his actions or just because of the things that happened to him, it was tough. So, yeah. All right, let's move on so we can get through these slides. I thought I was going to end real early, but apparently I'm just way too long-winded. All right, DBF4. We talked about the two covenants in Galatians 4:21 through 31, the two that were presented. We only have 16 minutes. You guys discussed it online. If we have time at the end, we can come back to it. But let's move on for now, unless there's something that you guys just absolutely want to discuss or talk about or throw out there. It's okay if you do. Nope. Okay. Let's move on. So now we're looking at chapter 4, verse 21 through chapter 5, verse 1. This is an argument from rabbinics. Paul adopted the position of the Judaizers to prove their point of view untenable, to prove that their point of view didn't make any sense. So, oh, come on. Oh, whoa. What is going on here? This is not what I wanted. Sorry, I should just bring my Bible. Lot easier. All right, here we go. Sorry about that. So let's read verse 21. Tell me who you desire to be under the law. Tell me you who desire to be under the law. Do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and he of the free woman through promise. Which things are symbolic. For these are the two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is and is in bondage with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. For it is written, Rejoice, O barren, you who do not bear, break forth and shout, you who are not in labor, for the desolate has many more children than she who has a husband. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are children of promise. But as he who was born according to the flesh then persecuted him who was born according to the spirit, even so it is now. Nevertheless, What does the scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. And then verse 1 of chapter 5 says, stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with the yoke of bondage. So the Galatians would admit to say that they're under the law. If we look at verse 21, if my phone will catch up with me, come on. Here we go. It says, tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? They'd say, yeah, we're under the law. Like, I hear the law, I understand. But then when he's talking about the law, Paul turns to Abraham and his account in Genesis rather than Moses, right? The Judaizers, they'd all say, like, hey, we're going to quote the Torah, so we're going to look at Moses, the law that he gave. We're going to go get all in the specifics. But the Torah includes Genesis through Deuteronomy, right? First five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. But if the Torah is the instruction of God to his people, then history, the story of saving acts of God, has just as much place in the Torah as legislation, right? So every aspect of the Torah should be equally weighed if that's the instruction of God. So undoubtedly, the Judaizers had laid more stress in Galatia on the ritualistic and legalistic aspects of the law. So if we're looking at the whole Torah, the Judaizers were focusing on the rituals, the legalities, all the rules, all the things that you can get caught up on, while Paul was focusing on the saving acts of God and the story of Abraham. So Paul retells the story of how Ishmael was born according to the flesh, while Isaac was born according to promise. Paul compared the Jews to Ishmael. Now, the Jews would always view themselves as being Isaac, right? They're like, hey, we were born of Isaac, we were born of the promise, we're the children of the covenant. But the Jews were the children of the covenant made on Mount Sinai, right? These Jews that were following the law. Now, this isn't saying like all Jewish people were terrible back then, but these Jews that were following the law, that were looking to the law for salvation, are the children of the covenant made on Mount Sinai, the covenant of the law, right? Not the covenant made with Abraham, which foreshadows the covenant of Christ. So the covenant of salvation by faith is being compared to the covenant of keeping the law. This bondage of the law is why the infant is being compared to slavery earlier in the chapter. And the Jews could be a part of Abraham's seed and Moses' law as long as they did not view the law as a means of salvation, right? So the Jews could be a part of both covenants, right? They were living under the covenant of the law, the covenant made at Mount Sinai. And then when they come to the saving knowledge of Christ, they enter into that other covenant, right? They become a part of the covenant of Abraham, Abraham's seed, and viewing salvation as a gift of grace through faith. Does that make sense? Okay, cool. Just want to make sure. Continuing in the argument from Rabbinics, Ishmael, the child of flesh, could not get the inheritance that Isaac, the child of promise, received. Right? It wasn't for both of them. It wasn't for all of them. It wasn't like, okay, well, if you continue in the flesh, that's fine. You all started from Abraham, so it's all good, right? Same thing with the covenants. The covenant of the law was made, and if you stayed in that, you couldn't both be given, or the covenant of the law and the covenant of grace cannot both give salvation. So unbelieving Jews and unbelieving Gentiles will not receive eternal salvation, while believing Jews and believing Gentiles can both be a part of the church. So there's no distinction, like we talked about earlier in the class. There's neither Jew nor Greek nor male nor female, whatever it is. That doesn't matter. What matters is the belief in Christ. So it is not a matter of who the person is or what the person has done, but rather about the Savior. Bring us back to that security of salvation question. But we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. Stand fast in the liberty of Christ and do not return to the yoke of bondage. We'll get into the liberty of Christ more next week, but I included this first verse not only because the commentary did, but also because like what it says about not returning to the yoke of bondage, right? We've been set free. We've moved on from that covenant of the law. We no longer need the law. The law was there. It served its purpose. Christ fulfilled the law and gave us this salvation by grace. And I understand, I know that I feel like I'm kind of beating a dead horse here. I feel like I'm going over this point over and over and over about moving on from the law to the salvation of grace. But I'm only doing that because I want you to know that it still happens today. Legalism is still going on today. People still return, whether, like, they're not going to admit, like, hey, I'm a legalist, or like, hey, I prefer salvation by works. You're not going to admit it, but people's theologies kind of start sneaking that way, the way they teach, the way they run their church, all this stuff starts kind of leaning towards that, whether or not they admit it or not. Cause just like the Judaizers weren't saying, like, hey, we're trying to enslave the Galatians here, so leave us alone, Paul. No, same thing with these churches, with Christianity today. It's not just people are going to say, hey, I want to bring you under the bondage of legalism. I want you to feel weighed down. I want you to have to earn your own salvation through your works. They're not going to say that. It's not going to be blatant. So when it's not blatant, when it's not wide out there in the open, it's easy for it to kind of sneak in to your thought process. So that's why I keep just drilling it into you. That's why I keep repeating it over and over. I know that you guys all understand the concept, but I just don't want legalism to sneak in here. Now, the tricky part is it's tough for Christians to find that middle line, because there's people that swing way towards legalism, but then there's other people that are like, I hate legalism, so they go, they get real liberal, and there's trouble at both extremes, but we'll get into that more when we're talking about the liberty of Christ next week, which should be interesting, should be exciting. So, yeah, that'll be fun. All right, I finished with 7 minutes left, so we have some time to either discuss the DBF right now or go over a few things about the essay. What would you guys prefer?
Essay.
Essay? Okay. So, let's bring up the essay real quick. Might take my whole 7 minutes to get this thing going. Hey. Okay. Come on. Do we have any questions about the exegetical essay while we wait for my computer to type? The topics, well, you guys are welcome to pick any passage that you want in either Galatians or Ephesians. Hey, you guys want to see some exegetical essays from last semester? No? Come on. Here we go. Let's see. Here we go. You want to see Christina's? She got at least a C- or something. I can't remember. Here we go. Oh, what's going on?
Do we have to let you know what passage we're choosing?
Yeah. So I suggested a few passages here that I think would be good to write your essay on, but you are not confined to these ones at all. I probably had one or two students last semester straying from the suggested passages. I'm not giving you these because I'm like, well, you can pick other passages, but you're going to get docked. No, I encourage you, if a passage stands out to you, if you get excited about a passage, go for it. Just shoot me an email. Say, hey, is it cool if I do this? Then I'll confirm it that it's okay. Not that I have like all the power over picking what verses are good to do an exegetical study on. It's just that I don't want you guys to get yourselves in trouble where you're trying to study like a whole chapter where that would take you way, way more words than 1,300 to 1,500. Or I don't want you guys to try and get 1,300 words out of like Jesus wept, you know, like there's some stuff you can get out of there, but it'd be a strain. So the reason why I want you to get it approved by me is that I want to help you out. And I apologize, I remember we went over this, but it says the book of Joshua here. If it says Joshua anywhere in this or refers to Joshua, just assume it's Galatians/Ephesians. So those are suggested passages. Read over these passages. Read over Galatians and Ephesians. Start thinking about what passage you want to do. Just because we're doing Galatians right now doesn't mean you have to stick to that. There's a lot of good stuff in Ephesians, but get going on it right now. Read over this outline. If you look at it, it's a lot of words. It doesn't look super fun to read, right? If you can believe it, this is, I think it's like half as long as the outline was for Joshua. I made a real long outline. I got very specific, but I shortened it down a little bit. But the reason why it's so long is because I wanted to get in depth. If you read this outline, if you get familiar with what I'm expecting of it, and you know what to look for, you know what to study for, you start reading the passages, you'll start making the connections, and you'll get a very good grade. If you hit each one of these points, if you meet all the requirements for the MLA and all that, and all the citing, and you engage in the biblical text and in the commentaries that you choose, you will get a fantastic grade. The reason why this outline is so long is because I want you to succeed. All right? I want you to be able to hit all the points that you need to hit. So if you guys have any questions, start reading over it now. If something doesn't make sense, I had people emailing me the night before it was due, like, what do you mean by literary context? What is that? I'm like, it's due, like, within 24 hours from now. So you shouldn't be figuring that out right now. You guys, if you have questions on the outline, figure them out pretty soon, right? Be working on it. Remember, if you get it done a week early, you'll get 10 points on your grade. That's a huge chunk of extra credit. This essay is worth a lot. So don't freak out. It's not going to be as difficult as it seems. I know it kind of seems overwhelming right now. It's not bad. Joshua, people, was it terrible last semester? Well, yeah, your computer crashed like 12 times when you were writing it. So. Yeah, that was, yeah. People that didn't have ridiculous circumstances, was it terrible? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's work, right? It's tough work, but it wasn't like. Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, if you struggle with writing, or if you can't remember this or that, or you have different things that are difficult, that's why I'm having you turn in a week early. I'm having you turn in a week early as your rough draft, so that I can point out, like, hey, you need this, this, and this. Just point out different ways to where you can get the highest grade possible. Or even before that, if you want to send me a partial rough draft, if you just have your intro paragraph in there and you want to say, hey, can you look this over? Is my thesis statement good? Or I can't remember when to use there, or whatever. Like, can't remember those. I want to be able to help you out. So get started on it early so I can help you out, because if you email me with questions the week of the due date, I don't guarantee an answer, because I'm going to be busy reviewing the ones of the responsible students that got into me early, right? So if you email it to me after or the week that it's due, your priority is on the bottom. The people that got in on time will get it all done, and then I'll get to you. Hopefully I will get to you, but that's why I do it, so I can have time to fully review it and get it back to you so that you can make all the changes that you need. Do you have a question? What was that? Yep. So you have to, for number one, for the introduction paragraph, you need to have A, B, and C in it. You need to have the passage, the objective, and the thesis. For two, you need to have A, B, C, and D. For three, you need to have A and B, and under these, you need to make sure you discuss the individual meaning and the collective meaning. So in your verse-by-verse study, talk about these two points. In your exegetical synthesis, talk about these two. Just make sure you're hitting every point. You don't need to have entire paragraphs about each short thing like this A. That doesn't need to be a paragraph. You can format it how you like. You can have it where the introduction is a paragraph, the context is a paragraph, the meaning is a long paragraph, and the significance is a long paragraph, and the conclusion is a paragraph. You can do that if you want. Might kind of seem like a run-on paragraph, so you can break it up. You don't have to expand on it a bunch for each point. That makes sense? But just make sure you touch on each point. That's about it for class today. Thank you. You guys were great. You guys are excused. What was that? Yeah. Yeah. Same thing as last semester. The process of the exegesis is in the outline. For what? I don't know what you said. You don't have to follow the outline plus exegete the passage. Like, this is the process. It's not the only process. I know there's other ways to go about it, but this is the process I want you to do. So, yeah, have a great day. What was that? There you go. You have to email me, so I haven't written.